If it pleases the court, my name is Doug Copeland. I'm representing the Webster Groves School District, which is the appellant in this case. Good morning. I'm going to begin by saying that even if this case were appropriate for a mandamus, because that's how it's come to you, and I feel it is not appropriate, it should not even be before you. The plaintiffs have failed to sustain their burden of proof. There are substantial factual allegations in the amended petition, which the school district denied in its answer. There was never any hearing, there was never any trial on those matters, and they remain denied.
So should we just reverse the remand for factual determination?
That would be an appropriate relief, yes, Your Honor.
Did you ask for a hearing?
Yes, we did. We asked, the pleadings before you are an amended petition, a verified answer, a motion to dismiss, suggestions, of course, in support of both of those, and then the judgment. There never was a hearing. We asked for a hearing both in our verified answer and in our motion to dismiss.
And but nothing filed by the petitioner was verified or sworn to before the court.
Their petition, their amended petition, was a verified petition.
Okay.
Yes, it was. But we, for example, we denied that the city that the student resided in the city of St. Louis. Obviously, that's critical to the application of this law to this particular plaintiff, and that matter was never resolved.
Mm-hmm. How does the school district typically do that? Do they just assume people are lying to them, or assume people's telling them the truth?
No, they require certain proof.
If they said they lived within the district, how far behind that proof would they look?
They look at, for example, driver's license of the parents. They would look at a utility bill. They would.
With every student who applies?
Pretty much, yes.
Was a student enrolled in the city of St. Louis?
To the best of my knowledge, the student was not enrolled in the city of St. Louis when she filed her first petition, no.
Did you also assert certain defenses that are factual in nature?
Absolutely. There's a wide variety of defenses, including the one that the Attorney General is here to address today, and we never had any chance to provide evidence other than the evidence we did provide in the verified answer. For example, there's this question of is there cost associated with taking the students in. In our verified answer, we did provide evidence that there would be cost, and we requested the opportunity, if necessary, to provide additional evidence as to the nature of those extended costs.
Is there an adequate remedy at law in these cases if no school district ever allows these children from unaccredited schools to ever go and the litigation lasts past the time they graduate, like what happened in the Turner case? I mean, can attorneys for school districts just continue to put off stall and delay and win that way? Is that how they avoid the clear language of the statute?
I think ultimately there absolutely is going to have to be a decision made, but it has to be made in the right form. I would suggest that mandamus.
Well, what was the Turner case?
When you say in the right form, I mean, oftentimes we don't allow writs if there's an adequate remedy at law. But
correct.
If somebody asserts or it appears based upon the practice of the various parties and the unequal bargaining power of single students, this wasn't a mass application, as I recall.
No, it was not.
So the impossibility defense, for example, that might apply if there were thousands and thousands versus allowing one person to go to school while the litigation continued would seem to be quite different. I mean, how's this ever going to be resolved other than a writ if it's actually apply to a real student?
Yes, I think it should be and will be resolved in a declaratory judgment action. I think the problem with the way this is presented to you, it's mandamus. It needs to be clear and unequivocal and unconditional, and I don't think
what do the real students that are freshmen, sophomores, or juniors or seniors now that would be entitled to an accredited education under the statute, where's the remedy for them in a declaratory judgment action for their individual right?
Well, I appreciate the fact that those cases are going to take time, but the consequences of this statute, not only to my school district and the other school districts in St. Louis County, but also to the city school district, to the special school district, are huge.
But what about the irreparable harm to a student who's forced to go to when the statute provides for it, forced to go to a school district that is unaccredited?
Well, and I would suggest that that's not irreparable harm. There are certainly schools within the city of St. Louis that could qualify for accreditation. There are certainly other options available to students within the city, whether they be charter schools or private schools, or tuition, as in the Turner case. Those parents chose to send their students to the county. Obviously, parents could move. They could be in a district that they do feel is appropriate for the education of their students. So there are many options.
But that's not what.
What about their statutory option that the legislature gave them?
Well, and
how's anybody ever going to get to enforce that? Apparently, absent a writ that applies to a real person. I understand in theory, some years down the road we may get the Turner case back or whatever.
Well, and I think that is going to be the ultimate decision must be made, and all the evidence must be presented to all the necessary parties so that they can understand, you know, the difficulties that a school district such as the Webster Groves School District would face when, yes, we can say this is one student, but if it's a clear and unconditional right, then that means it's not just one student.
Does Webster Groves accept voluntary, after the DSA case was resolved, certain school districts accepted voluntarily what were previously DSA students?
Yes.
Does Webster Groves accept DSA students?
They always have, and they still do. So
how many,
what
percentage of the student body?
The percentage of students from the city in the VIC program in the Webster Groves School District has ranged from 10 to 14% of our student population.
So accepting students from the city is not something that's foreign to Webster Groves.
We are not adverse to that. No.
Do they take tuition paid students from non-residents?
A few, yes. Yeah.
What do they charge?
The charge depends upon which grade level that they're at, whether they're at the elementary level or the high school level. The high school level traditionally is more. And I don't have an exact figure, but I would say it's probably about $12,000 at the high school level.
But you'd have a claim against the city school district to pay that until they get accredited.
And we've experienced that before with other unaccredited school districts, and the payment has either been non-existent or extremely slow.
Yeah. Obviously, did you seek a writ?
Did we seek a writ?
Did you ever seek a writ for payment? And could you have done that in this case?
We did not.
Counsel,
would you have had an adequate remedy at law if you had sought a writ for payment? If you'd accepted this student and sent him a bill and they didn't pay you, could you have sought a writ?
Collect.
Sent the student a bill or sent the sending district?
The school district.
Well, I think our remedy there would have been to file a lawsuit to against that school district to collect that amount.
The statute provides for the receiving school district to collect from.
And actually provides a remedy with the state school board if they don't pay it.
Well, and I would disagree with the state's position on that, because that remedy is if there's a dispute as to how much or when a payment is being made. But there's no dispute as to that. It's if a payment is going to be made. The St. Louis Public Schools have taken the position that they are not going to make a payment.
Counsel, if I understand you, you don't disagree that at some point or in some situations a writ may be appropriate, but there has to first be a clearly established right. And at this point, there's not yet. In fact, the Turner case is set for trial next month, and there may or may not be issues arising out of that.
Correct. And we raise the very same issues that are going to be before the court in the Turner case.
So you've intervened in the Turner case?
Have we intervened in the Turner case?
Yes.
No, we have not.
But this case raises the same defenses, you're saying?
That's yes, they
saying.
Do.
But the special school district filed an amicus brief, and is there any evidence in this case that the student involved here has disabilities, and there is the issues that the amicus brief raises as issues that need to be resolved?
There's no evidence one way or the other as to whether the student would require special ed services.
If you look at this case from just a fairness issue dealing with the two parties that are involved, the school district that you represent and the student who goes to the unaccredited school, in the sense of who can best weather the delay in the decision? I mean, can the school district weather that one more student for a year or two till a decision is made, or is the student more harmed than the school district?
If we were dealing with one more student, Judge?
Well, that's who's in this case. There's one writ, right?
Okay. But if we acknowledge that this one student has a clear and unequivocal right, and we have an unconditional duty, there are 60,000 other students right behind that student, and we could not possibly educate those students and not possibly
educate
the students.
Some are going to Metro High School. Some are going to the French immersion. I mean, there's a lot of programs in the city.
Absolutely.
And also, they're not choosing They may be choosing Clayton School District, they may be choosing Kirkwood School District. I mean, there's a lot of other school districts that they might choose besides Webster Groves.
We
it's
could
a
not,
very fine school district, that's why they chose them probably.
We could not handle 1% of the potential students that could come. That would be more students than we educate right now.
You're saying the basis for them asking to be admitted is not that there's room for one more student, but you have authority to refuse if there's too many. They're saying you have to admit all comers, and I'm a comer, so you have to admit me.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the whole nature of a mandamus case. It's clear, unequivocal, and we have an unconditional duty.
How many others have made a similar request for this school year?
For this school district, over 100 families, and I don't know how many students are in each one of
those. Some may be 100 parents, 100 sets of parents.
Correct. And that's all the while we're saying we're not accepting any students.
Right.
If we turn the corner and say, yeah, come on, I can only estimate.
But if you make the claim against the city, there is the fact that the city spends money to take care of the student if the student were a student in the city. So in essence, if you were asking for $10,000 and the city spends $7,000, if they stay in the city, well, you're making, it's, to the city, it's not that huge of a hardship.
And just
because they have an offsetting loss of funds, an offsetting cost they don't have anymore.
But just to give you some insight into the intricacies how this actually plays out, that student most likely will not be enrolled in the city school district. They'll be in a private school within the city of St. Louis, as this student was, and the parents see the opportunity. I'm paying $10,000 a year to go to this private school or this parochial school in the city. I now have the opportunity to go free anywhere I want to, whether it be Webster, Clayton, Ladue, or any district in the county. And guess what? I don't have to pay anything. Plus, I don't even have to provide transportation. So if you look behind the face of the situation and get down to the details and the practicalities, there are all sorts of situations.
But aren't those problems with the statute that need to be resolved across the street, not problems that get resolved here?
The problem that we have here is the statute enforceable? My understanding of the majority ruling in the Turner case is that the language of the statute is plain and clear. There are no other statutes that contravene the statute. But my understanding is the question remains, is this statute enforceable? We've got the Hancock issue.
I'm kind of getting that this is a bad statute from you.
Yes.
But the problem is when we have a statute, don't we have to, to go back and say this one child is saying I can't go to school, this one child is saying there's no accredited school district here for me, we have an obligation to them. The statute says if we can't fulfill that obligation in St. Louis, the child can choose where they want to go. Now, that's not something we get a monkey with. That's the legislature that did that. I mean, in so much of your argument here, one that must be fixed in the legislature, and we just have one child in front of us that's saying the statute gave me rights. There's an opinion from this court saying it's enforceable. What's going on?
Well, and I wouldn't presume.
I wouldn't presume
to tell you what your opinion said, but I understood your opinion to address the issue of does the language say what it means, what it says?
Well, the posture.
The opinion is a summary judgment.
If that case had been tried and had the same result, would this student be admitted?
If that case had been tried and this court ruled that.
I mean, it was undisputed facts, and we issued our ruling. There were
this court addressed
just
the issue
reversed of the summary judgment.
There are other issues you're saying beyond the one that was addressed in the prior case, which only addressed the meaning of the statute.
Correct.
As to whether or not you have a right to refuse under the statute generally, and there are many other defenses which are about to go to trial, which haven't yet been resolved.
Correct. And ultimately, if this court finds that this statute is enforceable, then yes, we will have to take this student and the next.
Well, I need to ask you a question about that. Isn't the issue whether or not there were any disputed facts left to be decided, not whether or not the statute was enforceable?
Well,
there may be defenses, but it does, you're not left this to any mystery as to what whether or not the statute is enforceable. I mean,
I'm not left to any mysteries about what the meaning of the statute is, but I do still question whether the statute is enforceable for a variety of different reasons that my understanding is the subject of the trial in the Turner case.
Wasn't there a footnote in Turner that said the parties didn't plead impossibility?
Right. There may be defenses, but
yeah,
the fact that somebody might have a defense is quite different than whether or not a statute is enforceable. Wouldn't you agree?
Well, it gets to the heart of mandamus.
I understand the procedure of this case is limited, just like the procedure of the other one. But for example, somebody had a statute of limitations, and somebody didn't have a statute of limitations, and the facts were the same. Somebody might be entitled to relief, and the next person might not be entitled to relief. The fact that somebody has a defense doesn't have anything to do with whether or not a statute is enforceable.
I guess depending upon the defense, impossibility is one issue. I think the Hancock Amendment is an issue that applies to that first student as well as...
It might apply to everybody.
Everybody.
Some defenses may be individual.
Correct.
Based upon factual circumstances. Some defenses may be true legal defenses.
True.
That's it.
Just, Mr. Copeland, are there any additional facts beyond whether the student lives in the district and is... and so forth?
Well,
need to be resolved before judgment.
Absolutely. Looking at the judgment itself, there was a suggestion by the trial court that the school district failed to sustain its burden of proof when we weren't given an opportunity to even offer any more evidence other than the evidence we did offer in our verified answer. So yes, there are other factual questions that need to be resolved. There were about seven items in the petition that were denied or were suggested that there needed to be strict proof of. Obviously, the most significant one is whether the student even resides within the city of St. Louis.
So you have a discriminatory material fact. But before we get too far, the parents, as you know, as a parent, your decision on how you get your child educated is important. So before we say the parents that send their kids to private school versus the city of St. Louis, but they'd send them to Webster Groves. If city of St. Louis was accredited and gave an education the state education department thought was appropriate, they may not have sent their kids to private school. And so they're just trying to make the right decisions.
Believe me, I do not mean to be cold-hearted to any of the parents in the city of St. Louis and the situation they have. But our primary responsibility is to the students that we have and to assure that they receive an appropriate education and that they have certain rights as residents of our district not to be in classes that are 10 times the size of what we feel is appropriate or whether we even have the buildings to sustain those programs.
Are there any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Copeland. You
Thank
have
you.
Another chance to rebut.
May it please the court. As amicus, the state of Missouri is here to address the argument of the Webster Groves School District. The section 167.131 violates the Hancock Amendment to the Missouri Constitution. Now, the purpose of the Hancock Amendment is to protect...
Before you do that, are you prepared to address at all whether there are existing issues of fact?
No.
You don't take a position one way or the other?
No.
Okay.
As an amicus, the state of Missouri sought...
I just wanted to make sure I understood.
Yeah. So we sought permission only to address the constitutional issue. So beyond that, we cannot represent the individual interests of the plaintiffs or the respondents here. The purpose of the Hancock Amendment is to protect the taxpayers of the state of Missouri. As this court has explained on several occasions, Hancock reflects the people's distrust of government to control taxing and spending on its own. And focusing on this purpose provides the answers to all of the issues raised by the school district's assertion. The first of these issues is so basic that it doesn't even really necessitate an examination of what type of Hancock claim this is, and there are several. This is so basic because the question is, does the school district even have standing to raise this constitutional issue? This court has clearly and repeatedly stated that only taxpayers have standing to bring an action to enforce the Hancock Amendment. This derives not only from the specific standing provision of the Hancock Amendment, but also from the very purpose itself. That is, that Hancock protects taxpayers. This court has said it is not the role of the Hancock Amendment to protect government. even from the state government. So it does not protect school districts or cities or counties from other governmental entities. And if the people did not trust government to control taxing and spending on their own, they obviously did not trust government to assert the people's rights and interests under the Hancock Amendment. So why is it that the Webster Groves School District here says that it can bring this? Well, they're saying it doesn't fall within the other principles because this is a defense. But there really should be no exception for a defensive assertion of Hancock. That would make absolutely no sense. And as a matter of fact, this court has already totally rejected the use of defensive use in the Health Board Trustees case. That might have been somewhat called into question in the Neske opinion, but there, not by anything affirmatively this court said or held, but simply because the court didn't address the issue.
But if I just get back to the basics, if Webster Groves accepts a student or gets a student from the city, then sues him for the cost of the education, isn't this just a transfer? It's no additional taxes that would people want to Groves, is it?
Well, if there's the tuition paid, the tuition isn't being paid by Webster Groves.
What?
The
city of St. Louis would be paying is obligated to pay the tuition. So,
well,
they
Webster
pay the
Groves
tuition,
can't assert the interests of the city of the taxpayers of the city of St. Louis any more than it can assert the interests of its own taxpayers.
Okay, I see. I was talking about.
I mean, taxpayers bring these actions, not school districts. Either now, my understanding is, although I'm getting this secondhand, my understanding is that individual taxpayers in the Turner litigation have brought a Hancock claim. If so, they are the proper entity. What I'm saying here today is that Webster Groves is not. And to get back to the basic difference here, factually anyway, as to whether they even have standing, a defensive assertion is really no different. And if we recognize such an exception, it would completely swallow the rule that there is no standing for local government entities. Because if a local government entity, such as a school district or a city, could do this, then they would simply ignore a statute, wait for somebody to sue them, and then raise it as a defense. They wouldn't even have to go to the trouble of filing and paying filing fee for a declaratory judgment action. I mean, so it would completely obviate and eviscerate the standing requirements that the Hancock Amendment has set. But even apart from the standing issue, there is another pleading issue here, and that is they actually haven't sufficiently pled the type of allegation that they're asserting. The particular type of Hancock claim here is under Section 21, particularly the new mandate clause of Article 10. Now, this court has said there are basically two elements: mandate, the actual existence of a new command to do something, and extra cost resulting therefrom. Assuming that there is a new mandate here because of the transfer of a student into the Webster Groves District, the question really becomes, what is the cost requirement? What is the cost element of such a cause of action, or in their case, a defense? And so the question is, if the purpose of the Hancock Amendment is to protect taxpayers, then this element of cost must impact again upon the taxpayers in order to trigger any Hancock Amendment protection. And that would mean that somehow locally generated revenue would have to be spent. And that's where the question of the tuition comes in. It's not locally generated in Webster Groves revenue that's being spent.
Of course, there would be a question of fact, wouldn't there, as to whether tuition covered all costs if you had to build new buildings or hire new teachers and so forth?
If we get past the standing issue and say perhaps a taxpayer brought such an issue, I would say that in order to adequately state a claim, they would have to allege that the tuition would be insufficient to cover any increased marginal cost by this one additional student.
And you're saying they did not.
And that's not what they pled. What they pled was that there was simply no appropriation from the state of Missouri to cover it. And that's true. But that's not sufficient under these circumstances. This court has said that in a slightly different context that you look at the net effect of a statute in order to determine cost of a mandate. That was the Missouri State Employees Retirement System versus Jackson County, where the county said, look, there's this Section 1 that imposes a new mandate, and that's going to be more expensive. And this court said, yes, but there's another section that relieves you of certain duties, and that's going to save you money. and you must always look at the net effect. Now, the net effect here is a little different because it's the tuition arrangement, but it's the same principle. It's somewhat similar to the Brooks case, where looking at it as a whole, there was a fee. The question there was whether the fee could be used to offset the costs of the background check and whatever else they had to do in order to issue the license. But that's the type of allegation that is necessary for this type of claim. And it's the type of allegation that is simply not made here. If the third party payment that is set up here in the form of tuition, or if the third party payment in the form of a fee, such as in Brooks, is not really going to be held to be compliant with Hancock, then we suggest in our brief that it may be necessary to address the issue that, that the Webster Grove School District raises, and that is that there is a requirement for a specific line item appropriation that would cover these costs. They rely on this court's opinion in Raleigh 31. And if the third party system of a fee or tuition or whatever is not going to be compliant, then I think it is necessary, and we suggest that this court reconsider its decision in Raleigh 31. Because frankly, in retrospect, I think it is much broader than it needs to be. In that case,
didn't we decide in the concealed weapon case that the counties can move the money around somehow, and the entities can move the money around somehow not to violate Hancock? We didn't require a line item.
I think there is language in the Raleigh 31 requires that.
What Brooks said was the money was given for a certain purpose, and that purpose did not include training for using guns, so it couldn't be used because there was a specific delineation of what it could be used for there.
Well, in Brooks, there was a problem unrelated to whether there was a state appropriation for it.
Right.
And that was, could the money that was being collected as a fee actually be used by the sheriffs to offset their costs?
Right.
And there was some doubt about that, or whether maybe it would be sufficient to cover it in all counties or not. But if that system is okay, you know, a third-party system, whether by fee or the tuition system here, we don't need to go beyond that because, frankly, they didn't make that type of allegation here. They didn't say the tuition would be insufficient. And until such an allegation is made by somebody with proper standing, i.e. a taxpayer, I don't think there's any need for hearing on that. But if there is a problem with that sort of system, then their reliance upon this court's opinion in Raleigh 31 that there
But that, that the tuition aspect deals with how you calculate it. I mean, if I went to college and I paid tuition, the assumption was my tuition paid for buildings or whatever else they needed. It wasn't that they it only paid for the teacher or the there's a lot more that goes into tuition that sustains the school. So I would assume if Webster Groves delineated their tuition, that could be challenged, it's too exorbitant, but if they delineated their tuition, it covers their cost of their buildings or maintenance as well as the direct education of the child.
Actually, I think what is generally charged as tuition by school districts in the state is really very generous in terms of what their marginal cost is of accepting an additional student. Now, if they want to try to prove that it would be insufficient to do that, you know, then they're perfectly free. But that in turn goes back to what this court has repeatedly said, beginning in Fort Zumwalt, that when you have this sort of mandate case, you have to look specifically at what the mandate is, specifically what the costs are. Discretionary spending is out the window. That isn't even included in the picture in terms of determining what the cost of the mandate is, and then whether there are sufficient resources appropriated. You know, that's pretty much the sort of analysis for either a new mandate or a pre-existing Hancock, mandate pre-existing Hancock. It's that sort of specific, rigorous analysis.
Which requires facts in evidence.
It requires facts, but it also requires specifically the proper allegations to state such an issue. And that is what they have not alleged here. They have not alleged that the tuition, their allegations are very conclusory. They just said, hey, we'll have to buy books or, you know, new equipment or whatever. But they never said that, all they said was that there was no appropriation. They didn't even acknowledge that the tuition was there, and they did not allege that the tuition would be insufficient. So without such allegations, there's nothing really to have a proper hearing on.
And the allegations or the defenses in the Turner case was that they actually had evidence that under prior circumstances, school districts are not likely to pay. They can't afford to pay. That's why they're in trouble.
I really have no knowledge of what's going on in the Turner case. I've been told that individual taxpayers have raised Hancock, and I know there was discovery going on just the other day with regard to that, but beyond that, I really cannot answer your questions.
Thank you.
I would trust that the issues will be raised in Turner, and it would be premature to deal with them now, because these pleadings do not allege a specific allegation of a viable Hancock issue. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Copeland.
Thank you, Judge. My father preceded me in the practice, and he always said when I brought him a question, look at the statute, look at the Constitution. I'm looking at the Hancock Amendment, and relative to standing, it says, taxpayers shall have standing to bring suit in circuit court of proper venue to enforce the Hancock Amendment. It says nothing about who may or may not raise it as a defense. I think the clear language of the statute allows the school district to raise it as a defense. And I think you've already recognized that in the Neske case, where you did look at the issue that was brought up as an affirmative defense by a political subdivision. You did decide in that case that it was not a Hancock Amendment, but you did not find that there was no standing, even though the court below issued its finding that the political subdivision did not have standing to bring it as a defense. So my interpretation of that case is you have ruled on that. As far as the health center trustees case, the commission had no standing on the Hancock issues in that case because they were unaffected by the amount of taxes collected. Their responsibility was limited to accumulating the levies assessed, certifying them to the collector for inclusion on the tax bill. So they had no justifiable interest in the issue at all. Let me just briefly, there's lots of issues to talk about, but let me briefly look at the issue of will the school district be reimbursed? So is there even a Hancock issue in the first place? A couple of different issues there. One is the statute itself, so there's that a condition precedent, a limitation, and I'm talking about the statute that allows students to transfer, that subject to the limitations, the school districts are required to accept these students. I would suggest to you that one of those limitations is that we receive tuition from the unaccredited school district. We asked the court below, and we suggested that the city school district was an indispensable party to this action so that we could get that resolved as well.
In the opposing council or someplace I've read, I know where there's an issue about, do you have to be paid up front or do you have to be paid later, that you're not reimbursed by the state till you find out how many students actually go and not paid in advance. Are those legal questions? Are those factual questions? Are those... how does that play into this?
Well, we would suggest that the statute itself solves that because it says that the school district, the unaccredited school district, shall pay and subject to the limitations.
Does it also talk about if there's a dispute as to the amount of money that the State Department of Education decides the issue?
Mm-hmm. That, yes.
As opposed to a court. So
yes.
So where's the harm in accepting the student, and if you guys disagree about it? And, I mean, isn't the thought process there that if we can't agree that a student shouldn't be closed out of a school because the two school districts can't agree who pays, and so if you can't agree, you don't even have to go to court. This is easier in arbitration. You just send it to us, and we'll decide the amount.
And I would agree
with
you.
And it doesn't even cost you anything.
Right. I would agree with you if the dispute is about the amount. This dispute is not about the amount. It's about whether there's going to be payment or not, whether the city school districts can afford, if a certain number of students come out to the county, if they will have any money to pay us, much less whether they'll have any money left to deal with the students that they do retain. Because not only do they have to pay the tuition, the cost of an education in the Webster Groves School District, Clayton School District, Ladue School District, but they have to provide transportation for each and every one of those students. And I would suggest the way the statute is written, that's going to be by cab.
Of course, the resolution
for each and every one of those students.
The resolution is to bring the schools up to accreditation.
Absolutely. Absolutely. At which time, all of these students, if they have been allowed to come out, will immediately have to return to the city schools. They'll no longer have the ability to attend. So if we build buildings If we've hired people to educate 1,000, 10,000 children, the next day that's all gone. And what happens to all that? There's so many different issues that are involved in this when you have the magnitude of a circumstance that we have now.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This case will be taken under submission.